Shrink Wrap Radio number 319, On the Frontiers of Neurotherapy, with Paul Swingle, PhD.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today, Dr. Paul Swingle, is author of the 2008 book, Biofeedback for the Brain, and we'll be discussing the branch of biofeedback known as neurotherapy. Paul G. Swingle, PhD, was titular full professor of psychology at the University of Ottawa prior to moving to Vancouver. A fellow of the Canadian Psychological Association, Dr. Swingle was lecturer in psychiatry at Harvard Medical School and attending psychologist at McLean Hospital in Boston, where he was also coordinator of the Clinical Psychophysiology Service. Dr. Swingle is a registered psychologist in British Columbia, certified in biofeedback and neurotherapy. His latest book, Biofeedback for the Brain, is published by Rutgers University Press. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Paul Swingle, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you.
Well, it's good to have you on Shrink Wrap Radio. I'm really glad to have this opportunity to catch up on developments in biofeedback, because I took a training from Dr. Thomas Baczynski back in the late 70s, and yes. I don't recall anything about neurotherapy at that time. It was all about biofeedback relating to galvanic skin response, muscle groups, hand temperature, and respiration, as I recall.
Yes, that would be the case.
Yeah, from your book, it's clear that things have moved along quite a bit.
Yes.
Now, you're in Vancouver, but somehow I hear in your voice that you might not be Canadian.
Well, I'm originally from New York City.
Yeah, that's
and
what
then,
I thought.
up until about 15 years ago, I commuted between Ottawa and Boston, where I was a professor at Ottawa University, and I was teaching in the Department of Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. So I'm picking up a little bit of Boston accent on top of the New York accent on top of an Ottawa accent.
Oh, yeah, and I was hearing all of that, and so I thought I should raise the issue. Well, let's start out by having you bring our listeners up to date by sort of giving us a definition of neurotherapy.
Sure. You commented that in the 70s, what you learned from the late Dr. Baczynski was basically what we call peripheral biofeedback, that is, the resistance of the skin, muscle tension, heart rate, and so forth. Around that time, the only thing we were doing with the brain basically is looking at what's referred to as the alpha frequencies. These are brain waves between about 8 and 12 cycles a second. And it's classically associated with relaxation. The more alpha you have, the more quiet and relaxed you are. So basically, during that period of time, there was very little going on other than it was considered an exotic form of relaxation.
Yeah, I remember that period, and I remember all the excitement about in relation to meditation, alpha and theta, and there was since I'm in California, there was a lot going on about all that.
That's right. It was considered technologically assisted meditation, I guess is the best metaphor for it.
Mm-hmm.
But around that time, the situation changed rather markedly. Dr. Barry Sterman at UCLA was doing some work on the effects of rocket fuels, hydrazine, on seizure threshold. This was a NASA-supported project. And by a series of chance events, he discovered that the cats that he had trained in a particular kind of way in terms of a brain activity were much more resistant to seizure evoked by hydrazine. And this was the birth, so to speak, of the neurofeedback treatment of epilepsy. Now, from that, the field just exploded. And basically what it is we measure particular functions of the brain in terms of various levels of activity. And based on those measurements, we can determine what is normative. And anything that's outside of normal range in terms of brainwave wave functioning is usually a predisposition to something like depression, sleep quality problems, anxiety, mood disorders, and so forth. Now, what that means, of course, is if you can see that there's an imbalance, so to speak, in a particular area of the brain, and you hook it up so that they're doing biofeedback of brain activity as opposed to muscle activity, we found that you can normalize some of these anomalous functions in the brain. And what happens under those circumstances is as you correct these anomalies, the symptoms remit. So basically, what you're doing is you're doing a fitness procedure for the brain. You're bringing the brain into more normal functional ranges. Now, an extension of that, of course, is you can optimize just the way an athlete does in the gym. You know, once they get their body into decent shape, then they can optimize particular functions, and these are the elite athletes. You can do exactly the same thing with the brain. And as many people may know, about half of the Canadian Olympic gold medal winners at the Vancouver Winter Olympics did neurotherapy.
No, I certainly didn't know that, and I watched a lot of the Olympics. I'm sure that'll be
news to many.
It was
our secret weapon.
were you the fortunate person who got to work with them, or was that someone else?
No, that was my old alma mater, actually, University of Ottawa.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, in your book, you give some outstanding case examples, and I want to encourage you to feel free to weave any illustrative stories or case examples into our discussion. And
sure.
I want to tell you that initially, I was a little put off in the introduction by statements to the effect that neurotherapy makes the brain more efficient. In what you just said, actually, you didn't talk about efficiency, but you talked about normalizing, which is more palatable to me, having finished the book now. And perhaps the efficiency phrasing was intended for the lay person, but my reaction was, do we really know enough scientifically about the brain to talk about efficiency? I've interviewed a number of leading neuroscientists, and none of them spoke about efficiency. We're still in the infancy of learning how the brain works, although great strides have been made. And I've always thought of EEG as kind of like, you know, because there are, what, hundreds of thousands or millions of neurons underneath any spot on the skull. So I've always thought of it as sort of like putting a stethoscope up to a refrigerator to figure out how the refrigerator or the dishwasher works. That was my, you know, my initial take. But as I read on, I became more of a believer because the word efficiency implied to me that we have standardized norms. And what I discovered as I read on was that, in fact, you talked about brain maps and normative databases. So, in fact, I began to have some feeling that, well, yes, it does feel like there have been some scientific development of brain maps and norms. So maybe you can speak a little bit to that.
Sure. We have several databases. There was one developed at NYU. The one that's commonly used, referred to as NeuroGuide and so forth. Basically, what they do is they measure the brain waves of people that have no clinical designated symptoms. In other words, a normal, quote unquote, mm-hmm. normal population. Now, what they do is they divide it up in terms of gender and age and so forth, and we can see what the norms look like. And this is just standard statistical procedures.
Sure.
So that you can determine if somebody has a brainwave activity that's outside statistical normal mm-hmm. range. So several of these databases are FDA registered and compliant. Now, there's a difference between a normative database and a clinical database, and this is an important consideration. Normative database, there are a lot of people walking around with what we call predispositions to conditions, but they're happy as clams. The reason is there's nothing that's turned the key to release that predisposition. Now, the biologists have been doing a lot of work, people like Bruce Lipton, for example, in terms of the environmental conditions required to turn on a neurological predisposition.
Yes.
Now, the difference now is an individual who's sitting in front of me in my clinic in Vancouver has a condition. They're there because they're depressed, for example. Now, what do I find in their profile that would be consistent with depression? Now, that's a clinical database in which the data are collected from clinical clients, those who, for example, report depression. And what does their brainwave look like? So it's more like pattern recognition as opposed to a departure from a normal database. So there's a statistical distinction here. And a clinical database is far more precise as a clinical instrument.
Yeah, I think in part what you're getting at is somewhat generic to the field of psychotherapy, that clinical findings versus research findings. And it seems like there's always a gap between the two. I think with the clinicians often on the leading edge and the researchers backfilling with scientific substantiation down the line.
I think that's a good metaphor. And my feeling is that the real discoveries take place in the clinic, in what I call practice-oriented research. And all that is system, being systematic about collecting data on your clients.
Yes.
That's really all it amounts to, and looking for patterns that emerge. And we're getting to be very, very capable of looking at subcortical regions in the brain so that we can do neurofeedback and brainwave work, neurotherapeutic work on subcortical structures. And there are a number of procedures used for this. And basically, in the early days, when I was at University of Ottawa, going back 20 years or so, what we were using is basically oceanographic data collection systems, so oceanographic software. If you want to find out what's on the bottom of the ocean, what you do is you send signals down from various locations, and then you look at the rebound associated with it so that you can kind of map out what's on the bottom of the ocean. Well, you use a similar kind of thing. In terms of patterns that are arriving at the cortex, at the various electrode sites, and then you plot all of that, and we can come within a few millimeters and a very precise localization of the generators of a particular waveform that we're measuring at the cortex. So we can do neurofeedback of subcortical structures, a very, very powerful neurological technique for correcting a lot of these conditions.
Well, before we get into the therapy, the biofeedback therapy, I'm interested in the diagnosis that you're able to do. In fact, you say that you're usually able to diagnose individuals based on what you're seeing in the brainwaves without them actually telling you what has brought them into the office.
Yeah, that's the exciting thing about the clinical databases. They are so precise.
Yeah, that was surprising to me.
As a local, I'm sorry.
I'm just saying that was surprising to me to read about the degree of specificity that you're able to bring into it.
There's a local psychiatrist who says that the EEG, you cannot diagnose on an EEG, is basically what he's saying.
Yeah.
And I love to call him up and repeat what George Bernard Shaw's famous quote, those who say it can't be done should get out of the way of people who are doing it.
Right. Right. I can understand that your feelings there.
Well, see, here again is the importance of a clinical database. What do these people look like when they come in and they say, I'm depressed? Where in the brain is that? Can you find that? And basically what we find is pretty consistent, and it's been something that we've known for the better part of 15 years or so, and that is if the right prefrontal cortex, the right frontal area of the brain, is considerably more active than the left, and there are a lot of ways that can happen, that's the signature for predisposition to depression. And if they're sitting in front of me, then it's likely that they're going to admit to being depressed. I'm not talking about the guy on the street that I've captured and done a brainwave on and say, hey, you're depressed. What I'm doing is dealing with a person who has a symptom. They're sitting in front of me. So whatever the predisposition is has been manifested by some kind of event. It could be fatigue, poor sleep, a trauma, who knows.
Yeah, in fact, speaking of trauma, you also say that brainwave monitoring allows you to identify the specific areas of damage in cases of traumatic brain injury. Can you give us an example of that?
Oh, yeah. We see a lot of individuals with brain injuries.
Like from car accidents, things like that?
Car accidents. We see hockey players and other professional sports folks who have concussions. And we do full brain maps and see the areas that have been affected by the injury. The typical thing in traumatic brain injury is the frontal cortex. No matter how you're hit, whatever location, whether it's top, bottom, side, or whatever, generally speaking, you're going to have damage to the front part of the brain. And the reason for that is the way the brain sits in the cranial vault. So no matter how you're hit, you're going to have some kind of frontal injury. And that's why you have one of the principal cardinal symptoms associated with traumatic brain injury are mood changes. And that's because the front part of the brain, particularly the right side, is damaged, injured in some way by the injury. And, it's part of the our culture in terms of knowing that individuals who have brain injury very often become violent. And some of the notorious cases of that of football players who become very violent after traumatic brain injury. So we can isolate those areas, and neurofeedback can be very helpful in terms of speeding up recovery. The other thing that's very important with traumatic brain injury is the old nonsense we were taught when I went to school, and that is you have an 18-month window. After 18 months of recovery, normal recovery, game over. You're not going to get very much more in terms of gains. That's just not true. And we have a lot of evidence for that. A neurologist in Texas, Jonathan Walker, a board-certified neurologist who does neurofeedback, has treated individuals 20, 30 years post-injury with very, very substantial improvement.
So, in other words, by giving sort of technologically assisted feedback, you're able to push the brain recovery past where it would go with just the mere passage of time.
Correct. And the reason for that is you're increasing blood flow to these areas. You get increased dendritic growth. I mean, all of this has been substantiated. Now, the other issue associated with trauma, one of the things I talk about in the book, of course, is not physical trauma, but the emotional trauma, again, associated, can be associated with something like an automobile accident, or it can be abuse, or, you know, rape, or whatever. Very often we can see that in the brain. You know, the brain has markers for trauma.
Mm-hmm. What you're saying sounds very exciting, and I'm bewildered that we haven't heard more about this in the sort of general media. And to what extent is neurotherapy controversial, if at all?
There are three levels to this. The first is individuals who had never heard of it. And if a person from the general public says they haven't heard about neurofeedback and neurotherapy, that doesn't trouble me very much. You know, it's a problem associated with our ability to get the resources and the PR and all of the rest of it. You know, I mean, we're competing with billion-dollar industries, you know, like the pharmaceutical industry.
Yes.
You know, and there's just it's no contest.
Right.
That doesn't disturb me as much as a neurologist, for example, who will say that he doesn't know anything about neurofeedback. In my judgment, that's malpractice.
Mm-hmm.
Because we are dealing with situations that have track records. Is FDA registered and compliant? The fact that an individual would not be aware of a neurological treatment condition, to me, is appalling.
Well, it seems like it ought to be taught in neurology programs in medical school.
It should be taught in psychology programs. You know, I had a program at Ottawa U. We had a program at McLean Hospital, you know, the teaching hospital of Harvard Medical School. There was one at University of Alberta, the one in North Texas, but they're very few and far between. We just do not have the biological or neurological orientation in our schools of psychology and psychiatry. You know, I mean, it's an outrage.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about doing all of this kind of psychological work without any basis in neurology. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, this really could be the marriage of all the recent findings that are, you know, coming from brain imaging studies and so on, are increasing knowledge about brain systems on the one hand, and our psychological verbal therapies on the other. And you do, in a number of places, you advocate, you say that neurotherapy should not be considered a standalone treatment. And it wasn't clear to me whether you meant that the neurotherapist should have additional therapeutic skills and not just rely solely on EEG, or if you were talking of saying that the neurotherapist should be able to refer out to other professionals for supplementary kinds of treatment, or maybe you were saying both.
Yeah, I think it is both. My feeling is that neurotherapy should be practiced by individuals who are licensed to practice a mental health or a health profession. That is, you should be a licensed physician or a psychologist or a social worker and so forth. Neurotherapy, as I've indicated, or neurofeedback, I guess, more clearly, is not a standalone discipline. If you're working with depression, for example, once you correct the neurological condition associated with that, you still have the legacy. A person has learned habit patterns, defensive structures, and so forth and so on to deal with the depressed mood state. An individual who's familiar with how you help an individual in terms of rapidly processing that in an efficient sort of fashion, I think is really important in terms of the marriage of neurofeedback with the other therapies. That's certainly the case in trauma. You know, if we have an individual comes in, I can't sleep, is their complaint, that they have poor stress tolerance. And you see that in addition to the neurological condition associated with stress tolerance, they also have a trauma marker. If an individual is not familiar with how you deal with emotional lab reactions associated with trauma, then they're going to be very ill-equipped to deal with a client who suddenly has trauma release. What do they do with it? Well, a lot of individuals will simply try to quiet the person down and then get rid of them. I mean, that's really the strategy associated with it, as opposed to a therapist who's comfortable with working with trauma. That the marriage of neurofeedback with other forms of trauma therapy makes it extremely efficient. I mean, we can deal with these severe traumas in a number of 10 or 15 sessions as opposed to 2 years of therapy.
Have you had any opportunity to work with veterans?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Because that's a huge
issue.
Problem these days with veterans returning from Iraq and the other places in the Middle East where they've been exposed to these improvised bombs. And I've heard it said that although lots of people tout approaches for dealing with trauma, I've heard it said that really there is no good, reliable approach.
Yeah, I don't believe that. And there are several things above and beyond neurotherapy that are very effective in this. You know, it's interesting. Where I discovered the trauma markers was working with Vietnam vets who had post-traumatic stress disorder. They were hospitalized, disabled by it. They all show this severe trauma marker, which is how I discovered it, basically. And when you work with releasing that and you have some other therapy as a mechanism for helping the person process it, then it's a very efficient procedure. Now, you know, there's a second part to that, and that is every one of the disabled vets that I looked at, in addition to having a trauma marker, also had the marker for predisposition to poor stress tolerance. And one of the issues we've been talking about with a number of the force agencies is what we call preparation for duty. And that is, if the individual shows that marker for poor stress tolerance, predisposition to anxiety, sleep problems, and so forth, they're the guys that are vulnerable to post-traumatic stress disorder. And again, where I kind of discovered that was, again, at Harvard Medical School with these disabled vets. Their buddies would visit them. And their buddies, I chatted with a number of them, they had gone through exactly the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
What's the difference between a guy that, you know, has some sleep problems, a guy that has some psychotherapy, you know, to deal with it, another guy who's troubled by it and doesn't want to talk about it, versus the disabled guy? What's the difference? Now, the military went through this nonsense of deficits of character and so forth and so on. But the bottom line was every one of those guys, the disabled vets, showed this severe deficiency of stress tolerance. I'm talking about neurological stress tolerance now. So, you know, if you put that on the front end, preparation for duty, then you I insulate the guy or inoculate the guy against, being more vulnerable to post-traumatic stress disorder. It's that simple and straightforward in my judgment.
Puts in mind the work of Martin Seligman, who has actually got a whole bunch of money to inoculate people against stress. Do you have any thoughts or observations about that approach?
Yes. Neurotherapy isn't the only game in town. You know, I mean, there are a lot of individuals who work with this concept of being able to quiet the neurological system. And I really believe that if you're trying to deal with something, you can sit under a banyan tree go into meditative, self-hypnotic, quieting states, or you can do neurotherapy. Neurotherapy, in my judgment, is just much more efficient and much more rapid. But nonetheless, there are other procedures to this. We work with, I do hypnosis, and one of the things that I've discovered is you can do what I call neurologically correct hypnosis. What I mean by that is you direct a person to image brain functioning, and you do the hypnotic inductions around that brain functioning.
Hmm.
And we get nice changes in brain activity associated with it. So, you know, there's nothing, neurotherapy is just another technological way of accomplishing some of these things. And in my judgment, particularly using my brain driving procedures, it's just remarkably more efficient, you know, because it's very direct and data driven.
Yeah, boy, that opens up a whole nother area that's of some interest, talking about brain drivers. And one that I've done some interviews around is a system called Holosync. And then there are brain driving apparatuses for people who want to engage in lucid dreaming, for example.
Yes.
Are there risks or dangers in brain driving? There are programs out there that use auditory signals to drive the brain. Is there anything to be worried about there? Because there's a lot of this is just available on the internet to the general public.
Yes, of course. you know, the old notion that remarkable effects require remarkable data. The flip side of that is anything that's efficacious, that has dramatic results, can have dramatic side effects. And that only comes with the territory. You can't have one without the other. Now, that opens up, we could have five more interviews about my feelings about that.
Yeah.
The first order of business is I don't feel that any of this should be done by individuals who aren't properly trained. The second thing is what's available to the public should be something that, again, is markedly limited in terms of the potential damage it can do. The notion that you're going to train up somebody in a weekend to do neurofeedback, I think, is laughable. And to provide things to the general public that have brain-driving capabilities without some mechanism for controlling side effects, there's a risk factor associated with that. The flip side of it is people are pretty robust.
Mm-hmm. I believe that, too.
You know, if they do something and they don't like it, they're going to stop. But some of the brain games that are available for kids, I think, are dangerous for kids that are vulnerable, particularly those that have an attention problem, for example. And the reason for that is the early games, one of the feedback waveforms they used was slow frequency. And the reason they did that is it's easy to work with. And slow frequency amplitude is the problem with ADD. So you're messing with something that can make a situation, you can really exacerbate a situation, in my judgment.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of ADHD, you say that the three conditions for which there is the most research establishing the efficacy of neurofeedback, including controlled studies published in peer-reviewed journals, are epilepsy, which you mentioned at the outset, depression, which you've also mentioned, and ADHD.
Yes.
Why these three?
Well, epilepsy by accident, Barry discovered that training up what's called a sensory motor rhythm, that's a rhythm between roughly 12 and 15 cycles a second in the cat, over the central part of the brain, the sensory motor cortex, when that's strengthened, the cat is more resistant to hydrazine-induced seizures. So that was quite accidental. Depression, individuals, one of the fundamental reasons that people come to therapists is for depression. So our catchment group, our population is much larger there. And I think it was just simply a matter of that, individuals who came in showed particular kinds of patterns, and we were able to demonstrate that you get this shift in activation of the front part of the brain associated with depression, both normally occurring depression and induced dysphoric mood states. ADHD, that's the bread and butter of the neurotherapist, and every child that comes in had loads of slow frequency. And if they were given a situation of arousing the brain, which was driving down slow frequency, you got these improvements. So it was kind of like a hit and miss a situation until we started to see what the patterns were.
Now you say
I think the real answer to your question is it was a function of how many people walk in the door. So we had more folks with ADD and more folks with depression.
Yeah. Now you say that the ADD kids had too much slow frequency brain waves, and that you needed to kind of speed them up. That made me think of Ritalin, and it's always seemed paradoxical that hyperactive kids would need speed. Is there some relationship here between that pharmacological approach and what you're doing with the brain?
Oh, yes. A particular form of ADHD, and there are many forms of, there are many conditions that give rise to problems with attention in a child. And a lot of my research is, can be captured by the phrase, are you sure it's ADD? Mm-hmm. Trauma, anxiety, sleep problems, et cetera, all give rise to problems associated with the kids paying attention. But legitimate forms of ADD, one of them is elevated slow frequency over particularly the sensory motor cortex, central part of the brain, an area of the brain associated with sensation, perception, motor movements. Now, if that area is hypoactive, then the child is self-medicating by bouncing around. So, they're bouncing
off the wall. That's an interesting way. It's an interesting way to think of it.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what it is. They're self-medicating. Huh. They're activating that area of the brain by being hyperactive. And the reason that a sensory motor system stimulant, which sounds so crazy, why would you stimulate a hyperactive child? The reason is it affects that hypoactivity of the sensory motor strip. In essence, making it more active, in essence, the child doesn't have to self-medicate. As I say to parents, we tend to think it's volitional, but it's really painful for that child to sit still. And if you think of it in that context, it just changes the way you deal with the child.
Wow, that's fascinating material. Now, I understand that you spent some time in China studying acupuncture and observed some correlations between the two. What can you tell us about that?
Yes, I was working with some electrical stimulation procedures based on some of the work that came out of Eastern Europe. The Eastern Europeans and Russia and so forth were miles and miles ahead of us in terms of electromedicine. They weren't crippled by the pharmaceutical companies the way we were. And, just looking at some of the things that they were doing with electrical activity, both alternating current and DC, pulsing DC currents, I tried it on a couple of acupuncture points, based on my discussions with some licensed acupuncturists. And it really looked promising. So I was very fortunate. One of my interns was a fellow from China. And he said, look, why don't we go over and get ourselves trained in acupuncture? You know, he had some, he had family right in Shanghai, and we had a look around, and one of the principal training centers was at, was in Shanghai, and it was also very fortunately associated with a psychiatric hospital. So we were dealing with acupuncture associated with psychiatric conditions, which was, I mean, what a minefield that was. What a gold mine that was. So we went over and got trained. And I was trained in needling. But what I use it in terms of electrical stimulation of acupuncture points. And I just went through and systematically mapped what stimulation of a particular acupuncture point does in the brain. And the reason acupuncture works is that it influences the brain in some way. I mean, it has to. The brain tells us everything, you know. As I love to say, it's all in your head, of course. Where else would it be?
Yeah, I have a catchphrase for the show, actually, that says something very much like that. You know, what you're making me think of is something I had not planned to ask you about, but I've suffered from ringing in the ears, tinnitus, for quite a while, and the research seems to, originally it was thought to have something to do with the tiny hairs in the cochlea, but more recent research seems to, first of all, it doesn't seem to be simple, and secondly, the brain seems to be more and more implicated, with some researchers investigating things like strong magnetic transcranial fields and so on. Have you had any experience or done any research in relation to tinnitus?
Yeah, we treat a lot of tinnitus. And there are various forms, as you say. It's complicated. The one that's a miracle waiting to happen is if it's associated with hypertension. And if it is related to hypertension, then you take care of the hypertension, the tinnitus, you know, improves. And these people are, you know, they think you're a miracle worker. The more difficult ones have to do with various forms of damage. And there's a whole series of things that can be done. One is, one of the reasons why these maskers tend to work is that the maskers at some point actually tend to reduce the subjective amplitude of the tinnitus because of the habituation effects. The second is match the sample procedures. And this is a feedback procedure in which you get the individual to subjectively match the amplitude and tone of the tinnitus. And then what you do is you reduce either the amplitude or the frequency, and you get the person to match the sound, the subjective sound they're hearing in the tinnitus, to the stimulus that you're presenting, the matching to sample procedure.
So you're trying to kind of get them to sort of drive down as they're as they learn to kind of reduce it softer and softer?
That's correct.
Okay.
Third procedure is to treat it, and we find that there's an area of the brain that is associated with involuntary movement that also improves tinnitus. That's very similar to the treatment for seizure disorders, by the way. And, of course, the fourth one is cognitive. And this is the one that we always emphasize, no matter what else we do, we always emphasize the cognitive, because the research is quite clear. Subjective distress and subjective amplitude are not highly correlated factors, which is counterintuitive, but that's the case. And what we find, and there are a lot of treatment centers that focus on entirely on this procedure, is if you can redefine the meaning of the tinnitus, it markedly affects subjective distress.
Yeah, I don't have a lot of subjective distress around it, and I've actually sort of, that's interesting to hear, because on my own, not having heard what you just said, I decided to try to use the when I become aware of it, to say, oh, well, that's a signal to remember to think about God, or it's a signal to meditate, a signal to be present here now. So I've kind of hit upon that myself.
Bingo.
But still, if I had a way to get rid of it, I would definitely choose to get rid of it.
Yes. Well, excuse me, that's you know, that's exactly the focus. Yeah, you're listening to the sounds of the universe, and only you can hear it, you know, that kind of mentality.
Oh, I like that idea, too. That's great. And, you know, you've been very sort of open-minded and wide-ranging in your openness to a variety of techniques. I understand that you've also done some work with EFT, Emotional Freedom Technique, or Energy Psychology, and that initially you were skeptical, but then became something of a believer. What changed your mind, and how does it relate to your work in neurotherapy?
What changed my mind was harassing colleagues.
Was what? Harassing what?
Harassing colleagues.
Oh,
colleagues,
yes.
That harass me.
Right, right.
Well, there's several levels to this. I guess I'm a slow learner. When I was at Harvard Medical School, a guy called me from New England Medical School, which is an osteopathic school, and he asked if I would be kind enough to bring my apparatus, my EEG apparatus, up to the New England School and do brain assessments of patients who are undergoing an osteopathic procedure. And I said, sure, why not? And what they were doing was cranial sacral therapy. Now, I didn't know cranial sacral therapy from, you know, a hole in the ground. I didn't know anything about it. And I hooked up the physician and the person he was treating, excuse me, and I set it up a couple of ways. One is though it were one brain, so that both the physician and the patient, it was set up as though that there was one brain operating there, and then also to measure the brains independently. And I did all the controls, you know, the hands on the table, hands on the shoulder, hands on the head, then the manipulation and so forth and so on. And when the guy did whatever it was he did, there were profound changes in brain activity. And the hair stood up on the back of my neck, you know, something that he's doing with the... He told me that the amount of pressure he was using was 5 grams. That's about the weight of a nickel. So, and it turns out, I think he was doing what's called a still point. But in any event, the you know, the short version of this is I registered the next week and got myself trained in cranial sacral.
And yes, I've heard people rave about that too.
And then I did the brain maps, you know, and it's true. You get these marked changes in terms of some brain activity, and then we use it for trauma processing. If I see a trauma signature that doesn't release rapidly with neurofeedback, I do a procedure referred to as somato-emotional release, which is a cranial sacral procedure to get the trauma to release. And when you release the trauma that way, the brain changes. If you change the brain, the trauma releases. So it's a bi-directional relationship. So that was one of the issues. The other was I took a course on EFT. You know, in one of these brief workshops.
Yes.
Frankly, I thought it gave nonsense new meaning.
Right.
So I was lamenting about all of this with a colleague who actually uses EFT, and he just told me, you know, you're pig-headed, you know. And what I did was I brain mapped it, and sure enough, one of the procedures increased a waveform associated with increasing seizure threshold. So I actually use EFT now with epileptic clients. But there's an interesting aspect to that in addition to increasing the waveform that improves seizure threshold, that is, raises the seizure threshold, it also raises another form, another brainwave amplitude that reduces seizure threshold. So I have to combine a couple of procedures to use, to have clients use at home to prevent seizures.
Mm-hmm. Well, boy, we're running out of time here. There's so many other topics and questions that I have that we could touch upon, but I think I'll have to skip over some of those. It's been 4 years since you wrote your book, and I'm wondering if there have been any new developments since then, and also where you see neurotherapy going in the future.
Oh, there have been huge developments. I'm finishing up the second edition of my clinician's guide, in which we cover a lot of these changes that have taken place, primarily in terms of diagnosis, what the brain actually tells us, and then ways of being able to correct it. As I said, we're able now to do feedback of subcortical structures, so we can go right inside the brain, and I really think that it's once the communities become aware of the potential for neurofeedback, that it's going to be the new medicine. And I think that's really what it's going to be. And it's going to replace all this pharmaceutical nonsense that's going on in terms of just sedating problems. Get medicine. Get the pharmaceuticals back to where what they're good at. Yeah, in terms of treating some of the physiological conditions, get them out of the arena in which they're destructive.
Yeah. That's a whole other big topic. What would be your recommendations as to how an interested listener might find a qualified neurotherapist?
What I would do is, go to bcia.org.
Can you give us the phonetics on that?
Yeah, it's B as in boy, C as in Charlie, I as in, what's the military for I?
Maybe India.
India, okay.
Yeah.
And A is in alpha, bcia.org, and that's the Biofeedback Certification International Alliance. These are individuals that are certified in neurotherapy. Now, all that means is that they presented their credentials for minimum qualifications, okay? So the client always has to trust their gut in terms of, does this person really know what they're doing? The second thing is somebody who's licensed to practice a health profession, a physician, a psychologist, social worker, and so forth. The best of all is word of mouth.
Okay, and as we wind down, I wonder if there are any final points that you would like to make.
Yeah, I really feel that neurotherapy and neurofeedback, as I said, it's the new medicine. And we have some real problems with cleaning out our own house in terms of individuals that are franchising all kinds of what they're calling neurofeedback and neurotherapy clinics. And the qualifications that these people have is warm blood in a checkbook. And so, the population really has to be cautious. There are several reasons that this is a concern. The most obvious, of course, are serious side effects with being treated by an unqualified person. But there's a more subtle one, and that is individuals who have done some sessions with this individual might have some mild improvement, and then later when their symptoms emerge again, they don't go back to neurofeedback because they think they've done it already.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they conclude that it doesn't work.
Bingo. And yeah. That happens a lot. The person would be told, go go see Swingle's clinic, you know. And they said, well, I've done that. They finally come in. And that's when they realize the difference between doing something like an assessment to find out what's wrong and then correcting what's wrong in a data-driven procedure with individuals who have other kinds of skills to be able to deal with your problem. I mean, it's a different thing entirely.
Yes, and that's definitely the impression I left your book with. Well, Dr. Paul Swingle, thanks for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. I've enjoyed it.
I hope you learned as much as I did from this interview with Dr. Paul Swingle. As you heard, my initial reaction was that his claims were overreaching in terms of what might be possible through neurofeedback. However, as I got deeper into his book, I realized both that the art and science of biofeedback has grown in sophistication since the last time I visited it, and that Dr. Swingle has a real commitment to rooting his work in a scientific approach. There are many issues I would have liked to explore more, such as his assertion that IQ can be increased by as much as 10 points, the varieties of brainwave frequencies and skull locations used for different conditions, the range of conditions he treats beyond the big three of epilepsy, depression, and ADD/ADHD, the role of brainwave feedback on traumatic memories, when he decides to monitor from 5 locations on the skull versus 20 locations, and so on. Actually, most of these questions and more are addressed in the book. Later, after the interview was over, I realized I really should have probed more deeply into his assertion that neurotherapists are now able to target subcortical regions. The implications of that didn't really sink in until later. How can you monitor what's going on beneath the cortex? That would mean having to filter out cortical activity, which I would think would be strongly in the foreground. If you are at all interested in this topic, I highly recommend his very authoritative and informative book, which again is Biofeedback and the Brain. It's available in paperback, and of course, you can order it using the Amazon widget in the right-hand sidebar on our site.
Can you imagine your world without Shrink Wrap Radio? If you've become addicted to the show and you need your Dr. Dave psychology fix on a regular basis, then you have to, need to, got to go to the website and click on the big green donate button. The more you donate, the better you'll feel. It's easy and gratification is instant.
Thank you, my sister Sherry, for that very professional promo and for your staunch support of what I'm up to here. And thanks to all of you for your donations, past, present, and I hope future. Let me extend a big welcome to any new listeners out there. I'm happy to welcome you to our listener community, and I hope you'll keep coming back for more as others have done, and I hope you'll help to spread the word. Okay, this is your last chance to join me and some wonderful Swedish Shrink Wrap Radio listeners for some dream work in Stockholm on Saturday and Sunday, September 8 and 9. You can find full details on the site. Just click on the Swedish flag icon in the right-hand sidebar at shrinkwrapradio.com, and that'll give you all the information that you need to sign up. Or at this point, you can simply just show up. And again, all the necessary details, including the address, are on our site. And because I'll be gone for about a week, the next episode of Shrink Wrap Radio will be about a week or so late. So that's a good time for you to catch up on back episodes. And speaking of back episodes, I've heard from some of you that you can't get the early episodes off of either iTunes or the Shrink Wrap Radio podcast app. Of course, they are all available on our site by right-clicking or control-clicking on the download button of each individual show. That can be a pretty time-consuming task, though. So if you'd like to save yourself that hassle, I can send you a DVD of MP3s for episodes 1 through 25 and or 26 through 50 and or 50 through 75 and so on at a cost of $40 per 25-episode DVD, which will also cover my time and expense for shipping and handling. So just let me know if you're interested. There is a new transcript on our site, thanks to Jeremy Devins. Once again, he's been the major transcriber of late. And this is Shrink Wrap Radio number 260, Whole Psychiatry with Robert Hedaya, MD. Please contact me if you would be interested in being a volunteer transcriber and helping Jeremy out, who's carrying so much of the load right now. Also, I want to announce a new CEU course for 8 units. It's called Spirit Meditation. It's part of a series that I'm doing on mind, body, spirit. And also, I want to reannounce the new mind-body course in that series called Body Mind, Goodbye to Dualism for 6 CE units, which consists of 7 interviews covering body mind. So, wow, there are so many possible CE units there that I have lost track. I had been saying more than 60 CE units that you can earn by just listening to these podcasts, and there are more on the way. At around $10 per unit, they're a real bargain. So just go to the store tab on our site for full details. I think there must be probably around 75 units possible by now, and I'm still working on it. Dr. George Lau has been trying repeatedly to leave his very positive review of Shrink Wrap Radio on iTunes without any success, and we're not sure why. If you haven't left a review there, would you please do so? It would help us to assess whether iTunes is broken in regard to the ability to review Shrink Wrap Radio. We haven't seen any new reviews there since mid-July, and so we're wondering if it's broken, if it's reached its limit, or what. So if I see some new reviews up there, that would help us to diagnose what's going on. The good news in regard to iTunes is that I see our show is still listed on the What's Hot in Higher Education page. Hooray!
Hi, this is Jerry Trumbull, continuing my inner space explorations in Denver, Colorado. And you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thanks, my old buddy Jerry. No, I'm afraid Jerry is not my next guest, but it's good to hear his voice and think about having him back at some point. Right now, I'm pressing to get through a rather long list of guests that I've lined up already. Okay, let's dip briefly into our electronic mailbag for the latest from our listener community. And actually, because of time, I'll only read this one short one, and I can't even remember if I read this one before or not. But Karen writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. I'm trying to get your app from Podcast Box, which I downloaded, but when I go to categories and go to science and medicine, there are only 4 podcasts there, and yours isn't one of them. What's my problem? Thanks, Karen." And Karen, I do think I answered this before, but there might be other people suffering from the same issue. And when you download Podcast Box, you need to look under the category of education. And if they have it, higher education. That's my listing in iTunes, is under higher education. For better or for worse, there were so many categories to choose from, and none seemed exactly right. And now I'm kind of stuck with that choice from some years back. So I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails, as always, to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. In addition to emails, you can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where I'm ShrinkPod, and you can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-337-0622. You can also leave voicemails on the aforementioned iPhone/Android app, about which you can find full details in the Apps tab at shrinkwrapradio.com. Thanks to today's guest, Dr. Paul Swingle, for getting us caught up on the exciting developments in biofeedback for the brain, or neurotherapy. My next interview will continue the theme of somatics with an interview with my longtime colleague and friend, Dr. Eleanor Criswell, who, among other things, is editor of the Somatics Journal. She's a fascinating person, having been involved with the practice and teaching of yoga, biofeedback, Feldenkrais, Hanna Somatics, and so much more. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.